The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
To my successor, whoever he or she may be. Number one, stay close to the Americans, stick up for the Ukrainians, stick up for freedom and democracy everywhere.
Politics in general has taken total leave of its senses.
Changing one man at the top of the Tory party won't make any difference. It won't fix the problems. Let's have a fresh start for Britain. Let's have a real change of government.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics, your daily guide to the corridors of power. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. Coming up on today's programme, as UK economy contracts, Bloomberg's David Goodman on what today's GDP figures tell us about the coming winter.
And no fewer than 9 rail companies go on strike this weekend. The next wave of labour unrest. We'll get a conservative take on how to get Britain back to work from the Institute for Economic Affairs. Well, happy Friday, Lizzie, and also to Bloomberg's David Goodman, who's with us in the studio. Now, Lizzie, there is some evidence with those GDP figures today that services spending on some fun things helped to cushion the slowdown in June GDP. Now, would it be a bit harsh for me to say that you weren't out boozing for the Queen's Jubilee weekend?
I feel like you're teasing me for being teetotal. But actually, Ewan, I would argue that my lack of a hangover on the Tuesday perhaps promoted economic growth. Don't know about you.
Well, only if you went out and spent some money on stuff. Well, yes, my contribution to the economy was pretty poor over the Queen's Bank Holiday weekend because I was in the office because TV, the world of TV continues. TV news rolls on. So both bank holidays, I was here. So I think my spending was very limited indeed.
What about you, Dave?
I've got a toddler, so I haven't been out of the house for about 18 months, to be honest with you.
Dave has no life.
So you're not helping with the economic recovery whatsoever.
No.
David, now just to talk us through the top line figures from the GDP data today.
Sure. Well, I think the main line is that the economy contracted in the second quarter. It contracted by just 0.1%, so not a big drop, but it's obviously any time the economy contracts, that's not great news, and it's pretty much in line with what the BOE and other people were looking for. In June, we saw a slightly bigger drop of 0.6%, but there's some, as you say, there's some factors around the Jubilee that make that slightly more difficult to interpret.
Okay, we're going to come back to GDP, but earlier today, our other Bloomberg UK Politics host Stephen Carroll and Bloomberg's Alex Webb sat down with economist Diane Coyle, who's Bennett Professor of Public Policy at Cambridge University. They asked her what she made of the figures.
Health warning is that you should never take the first quarterly figure too seriously because they do get revised and it's a small decline. But the bigger picture here is that the economy is clearly slowing down. Part of the contraction that we saw in this quarter was health activities related to the pandemic stopping. But the other part was consumers being much more careful about their spending. And that's not really surprising when you think about the news about what's happening to energy bills over the next year or so. Food prices gone up for those people on variable rate mortgages starting to go up. And so the discretionary spending that people can do is shrinking. And that's going to get worse over the autumn.
Given the decline, does that mean that almost automatically the third quarter is likely to be better?
No, I don't think there's any automatic here. And there was a dip in June related to the bank holiday, and so you would get some bounce back from that in July. But I think it's a pretty bleak outlook for the UK economy at the moment. We are doing worse than most other international comparators. Brexit is still hitting trade, so we've got a weak export sector, and the impact on households is going to be really severe. You mentioned the forecast of a £5,000 a year energy bill, and the median income, household income in this country is £31,000. That means that half of households have less than £31,000 a year. And when you think about the chunk that's going to get taken out of that by things that people have to spend on, their heating, their cooking, lighting, food, housing, that doesn't leave much money for spending on other things. So I think we're very likely to see further contractions.
Tell us what you think the next important data point will be to watch when it comes to the UK economy. We have been seeing retail sales figures holding up, but that's due to inflation. Volumes from the latest BRC figures were down, but the overall headline figure was up. What are you watching out for next as the next key indicator?
I suppose the canary in the cage will be those discretionary elements of spending. And they have held up so far. Things like going out to events or dining out. And partly, of course, people have been glad to get back out in the nice weather because of the Jubilee celebrations, because of the scaling back of the pandemic. And once the things that people have to pay for start biting, those increases start biting, and everyone cuts back on discretionary spend, that will be one of the early warnings, I think, about an impending recession.
Well, that was Diana Coyle, Bennett Professor of Public Policy at Cambridge University, speaking to us just a little bit earlier today.
So, Dave, what did you make of what Diane said? We also had Callum Pickering from Berenberg on Bloomberg TV and radio earlier today, and he's very different to Diane in terms of his views on how much Brexit contributes to the UK's economic performance now. You heard what Diane says. What do you reckon?
I think, obviously, the main thing that jumps out is that what's ahead is worse than what we've seen recently, and that's certainly what's going to happen this winter with energy bills going up and that kind of thing. I think in terms of Brexit itself, I don't think we're at a point where we can be like, every quarter, is this to do with Brexit? Is this not to do with Brexit? Brexit is always there, and it's always probably just like slightly reducing the UK's growth potential. I think that's what we're seeing. It's this kind of long-term kind of puncture, really, rather than anything massive.
David, where does this leave the Bank of England? I mean, these weren't kind of shockingly fascinating GDP figures, were they? So presumably it doesn't move the dial particularly. But just sort of talk us through what the expectations are for rate rises over the course of this year.
Yeah, I think, as I said earlier, I think they're pretty much in line with what the BOE were thinking. I mean, 0.1% here or there isn't a big difference. I think the market seems to think we're heading for another 50 basis point hike in September. What we saw policymakers say in August, although they were saying everything's on the table and we're not kind of pre-committing, obviously, I don't think anyone was really pushing back against the prospect of that. And given that we're going to get an inflation reading next week, that the moment is forecast for 9.8%, but as we know, people have massively underestimated inflation almost at every turn this year. So if we have double-digit inflation reported for July, then yeah, 50 basis points very much seems to be the kind of central case for September.
Yeah, I keep asking economists, why don't they just change their models after you've got it wrong seven times now?
Maybe they are changing their models and they're still getting it wrong. I think that's a scary thing.
Yeah, but economists getting things wrong, I mean, that's just part of the profession, isn't it? I mean, if economists got everything right, it wouldn't be economics.
So speaking about getting things right, lots of commentators have said that the Bank of England's forecasts of this five-quarter-long recession are too gloomy because, of course, they can't take account of unconfirmed fiscal policy. But Dave, given that it's likely we're going to get a Truss premiership, given we know that she wants to make £40 billion of tax cuts, is a recession still inevitable? She says it's not.
Well, I think it's even the BOE's forecasts are even more gloomy than that. It's seven quarters without growth, five quarters of kind of proper contraction, then two without growth. So, I mean, these are really far more gloomy than anyone else is looking at. And that's partly because the BOE are factoring in a far bigger increase in energy prices than other people are at this point. In terms of whether the one's inevitable, I mean, it looks like no matter how much you do around tax cuts, you're still going to end up with a recession. I think we had some research in Bloomberg Economics out earlier this week showing exactly that. And yeah, there's only so much you can do because tax cuts take a while to kick in and they take a while for that money to come back to you. So in the short term, it's all about whether there's any more kind of direct fiscal help for households. And in terms of the BOE getting it wrong, I mean, they kind of have to just take things as read at the moment. They can't be in the business of predicting fiscal policy given how, I mean, what we've seen. Feels like we've seen about 10 budgets this year. I'm sure that's not the real number, but it changes so quickly.
Feels that way to an eco reporter.
Exactly, yeah. So you can't really they can't really factor in all these changes that might be coming in.
David, I hesitate to ask you a question which has touches on Brexit as well, but how important is the hot labour market to the UK? It does feel that it's something that's slightly different in the UK to the rest of Europe. And I guess it's both a positive and a negative, and as far as the fact that everybody's got a job and wages are rising should be good for GDP, but also it's a problem for inflation, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think the UK kind of has, people have talked about having the worst of both worlds for inflation. You've kind of got the hot labour market of the US and you've got the kind of energy price shock and other things from Europe. So yeah, it's from an inflation point of view, it's not great. I mean, I think there may be some signs of slowing in next week's jobs data that may kind of show that some of that tightness is starting to give away. And certainly, as we see growth start to drop off, and if we do get this kind of five quarters of a recession, then the expectations are that we will see a kind of pretty big jump in unemployment on the back of that. So, yeah, I mean, we may have already passed the peak for the kind of tightness of the market, I think.
You've got a story on the terminal about the potential impact of Liz Truss, the frontrunner to be the next PM's plans in terms of reviewing the Bank of England's mandate, potentially driving investors away from sterling and gilts. But what I wonder, coming back to Brexit, is it how the next leader handles Brexit that's more worrying than the questions of the BOE or fiscal policy?
I think in the short term, obviously, what they do around fiscal policy is the most important thing. And for households, for you and me, for people we know,
no, how I'm going to be all right. I've got a wood-burning stove.
Oh, of course. But like how that all plays out is the most important near-term factor, I think. And that's going to determine how deep a recession we see. I think, obviously, the approach to Brexit, again, is a longer-term issue. And how that kind of plays out is more of a kind of where the UK growth kind of goes over the next 10 years. And that may be what investors look at, I guess, after the turn of the year. But at the moment, I think the fiscal policy is the real kind of big story. And the mandate becomes an issue when it becomes an issue, I think, for investors. People are worried about it and worried about it changing, but they're not really pricing anything massively in for it yet. I think if we do get a substantial change, that's when we might start to see some big market reaction.
But, you know, if she goes the whole hog, if Liz Truss goes for blowing up the Brexit deal and we get a trade war in retaliation from the EU, that's only going to add to the cost of living crisis. So I really wonder, you know, how the next leader, given they're both professing to be hardcore Brexiters, can find a way out of this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think obviously you have to just look at the politics of it. And if you're fighting a Tory leadership race, you kind of have, everyone has to be kind of the most extreme position possible. So yeah, I mean, what they say in the race and what they do in government is probably
campaign in poetry, govern in prose.
Something like that, yeah. That's...
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Boris Johnson met the bosses of energy companies yesterday, but no new plans were revealed to try to help households or businesses with soaring costs. Now, the energy consultancy Auxilion says that the average household bill will surge past £5,000 in 2023.
The next jump will come in October when the energy price cap goes up. Stephen Carroll and Tom McKenzie have been speaking to Auxilion's director, Tony Jordan, about whether the cap system needs to be changed.
Is it fit for purpose, I think, is a question that's coming up. And if we think back to a year ago, how many people had heard of the price cap? Whereas today, everybody knows what it is. Everybody's watching it very closely, and rightly so. So I think the design of the price cap itself is coming under question. It's difficult to know what to do next, because the design is the design that we have to live with today. There's not a lot that the government, Ofgem, or indeed energy companies can actually do to change where we're going to see the next couple of caps.
Tony, the government could subsidise. I mean, we pay far more per kilowatt hour than the Europeans do. And that's because European governments are subsidising at a heftier pace. The British government could do more. What would it cost?
Probably vast sums of money. So the price cap at the moment is, so the one that's in place today that came in April, about 54% of it is made up of the wholesale cost, with the other 46% being other costs. So the networks, the operating costs, the VAT, etc. That's going to move to around 70% of wholesale costs in the upcoming cap. So 30% of the other items. In January, we forecast that as high as 90% wholesale costs. So there's less movement around the tangible things that they can move. So there's talks around removing or reducing green levies and VAT. The reality is those items in isolation will only take out a small percentage of the cap. If you try and hold a potential cap going to somewhere around, you know, £3,500-£4,000 in the coming months to the level that it's at today, around £2,000, with 20 million households, it's going to be tens of billions that we need to fund that kind of subsidy.
When we look at those sort of structural changes to the energy market, though, is it something that's worthwhile in the short term to look at taking more drastic action to try and combat? Because £5,000 for the median income in the UK is absolutely huge.
It is indeed. I think there's a lot of questions that have to be asked around what should the structure of our energy markets be, particularly in relation to the price cap and what it's designed to do. I think yesterday's meeting with the government and the energy companies, as we probably expected, resulted in no particular outcome, simply because I think they don't really know what they can do as energy companies. There's not a lot they can do. They're following the rules that's been laid out by Ofgem. It really comes down to the government to put their hands in their pocket and subsidise in some way. But as I say, the numbers that we're potentially looking at are vast. So we have to look at how much are we going to borrow in order to put that in place.
That was Tony Jordan, Director of the energy consultancy Auxilione.
Now, from nurses to barristers, dockers to posties, workers across Britain's industries and professions are ramping up plans for strike action this autumn. The prospect of a so-called summer of discontent, a nod to the 1978 winter of discontent, has loomed since UK inflation rose sharply earlier this year.
4 days of public transport strikes will test the patience of commuters starting this weekend ahead of 3 consecutive days of disruption from next Thursday. Well, let's get a view now from the think tank, the Institute for Economic Affairs. Matthew Lesh, the IEA's head of public policy, joins us now. Matthew, the Bank of England sees inflation hitting not just double digits, but above 13% in the autumn. Surely that means the unions now have more chance of securing bigger pay rises.
I mean, I think the inflation figures are frightening for us all. In many senses, we do have a perfect storm for industrial disputes. It's not only the kind of frustrations that were built up over lockdown, as well as pay restraint over the last decade. These large inflationary pressures are leading to quite big demands from the unions. But I think we need to be a little bit careful not to directly compare this to the winter of discontent. This is quite a different situation for a number of reasons. I mean, to start with, just that the proportion of the workforce who are union members is significantly declined from about half of the working population in 1979 to around 23% today. And if you look at the amount of working days lost to strikes in 2018, it was to make 273,000 compared to over 29 million in 1979. So the kind of power and influence of the unions is substantially declined. Where we're seeing these strikes is largely on the old industrialized, unionized sectors, largely in the public sector or in the privatized public utilities like the railways or Royal Mail. So I don't think we can expect the kind of broad-scale strikes of the 1970s, but there will be disruptions, particularly in the railways, over the coming weeks and months.
Interesting figures. Nonetheless, strikes are certainly on the up. I think that's more than anecdotal, isn't it? Does Britain have a strike problem, or is the current unrest just to be expected given the inflation figures which Lizzie mentioned?
I mean, it's hard to say what the definition of a strike problem would be. I think every strike is a problem for those people who are impacted, who might be wanting to commute on those particular days, or if the Royal Mail goers are on strike, those who don't get their letters and packages delivered. And therefore, that is problematic for a lot of people. I don't think we're seeing the kind of mass strike kind of response. I think there were some changes the government could do that would potentially reduce the impact of strikes. There's been a lot of discussion, for example, about introducing minimum service agreements. This is quite commonplace in continental Europe that says when these organisations do go on strike, there's still an expectation that 20 or 30% of the service has to continue to be delivered for public safety and and public needs. So there are steps that certainly could be taken to minimise the impact of strikes, but to some extent, this is the reality of the politics of inflation, which is that when you have inflation, it does lead to more political instability, more anger and industrial strife.
So the Centre for Economics and Business Research estimated that it would cost £100 million, the June strikes in transport alone. Does the Institute for Economic Affairs have a figure for how much all these strikes across the summer are likely to cost the economy?
Look, unfortunately, we don't have any particular figures that we've calculated. I mean, it really ultimately depends on the kind of length and nature of some of these strikes. I think they're going to quite clearly have big impacts on some of the businesses. For example, a company like Royal Mail that's now largely in the business of package delivery, they're going to potentially lose a lot of business to other companies who don't have people going on strike, who don't have unionized workforces. So I think we're going to end up seeing in those kind of sectors a lot of change in behaviour. I think in the railways, the big issue, underlying issue of the railways, is the fact that post-COVID, the number of commuters is significantly decreased. That means a lot less ticket revenue, and it means the current level of service is not financially sustainable without large government subsidies. In that context, it's very hard to promise big pay rises that are being demanded by the unions. So you've got that underlying structural issue. A bit of the longer-term danger is if they're keeping going on strike, it's very unlikely that people are going to start returning to using the railways in the way they have previously, because of the lack of certainty behind the service. So that could be an even longer-term cost to the railways and ultimately to the government who might be forced to subsidise them to keep them running.
Matthew, do you think that some other European countries manage industrial relations better? Germany, for instance, where workers are often well represented on company boards?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly different union cultures. Britain famously has a relatively aggressive, the workers versus the bosses culture, at least historically. I mean, I think I would like to see a better culture around working towards productivity and workplace improvements in exchange for pay rises, particularly in the public sector, that could be beneficial to the workers directly through high wages, but also to the users of services. Germany's got a very different historical culture when it comes to the place of unions. I mean, that can work. That can be good in certain cases. During the financial crisis, famously, the unions agreed to reduce salaries for all workers instead of some workers losing their jobs. They can also at times mean a lot less flexibility and a lot less competition when you have conspiring between the unions and the bosses of companies. It doesn't necessarily end up in the broader benefit of the economy or innovation and progress in that respect.
And just briefly, in our last minute here, the Thatcher and Major governments tightened the laws around strikes. Now, in 2022, do you think we have a good balance?
I think there's an argument for rejigging the laws in certain respects. I mean, it's worth noting that the trade unions have certain protections. If they follow the rules, generally speaking, they can basically strike without the repercussion of losing your job that you would normally happen if you didn't show up for work. And there's some proposals to change, for example, the turnout required for those ballots to increase the percentages or change the nature of the bargaining unit. So I think some of those reforms could be beneficial to ensure that if strikes do happen, that they have a strong level of support from the workers, that it doesn't become a default behaviour to go on strike and make other people's lives miserable.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.